Good afternoon, and thank you very much for the introduction. Nobody resonated with me, and still doesn't, as Rav Soloveitchik as the Rav. His Torah, for some reason, when I learn it, it just makes so much sense. And I share a lot of it with my Balabatim, and they say, Rabbi Muskin, why can't you share any Torah from anyone else? And they keep on saying, the Rav, that's all you say. And there was a very good reason, because his Torah was so powerful, and it just made so much sense. I'll tell you a quick story, and then we'll begin. I just came from the lecture by Dr. Schneer Lyman. Dr. Schneer Lyman and I went on a trip to Vilna and then Minsk many years ago, and we brought the first Sefer Torah to Minsk since the Holocaust. And on that trip, we were going from Minsk to the airport to fly back to America. And I don't know how it came up. I was Zocha, I had the merit of being the roommate with Dr. Lyman on the trip. And I don't know how it came up in conversation, but we were talking about the Rav, and he said, 1,000 people would look at the Gemara. 999 would think they understood it. And then Rav Soloveitchik would come, and he would share his interpretation. And everybody would scratch their head and say, why didn't we think of that? And that's exactly the man I want to talk about this afternoon with you. A nuanced view, the Rav's view of religious Zionism. A number of years ago, I heard a comment made by Rabbi Dr. J.J. Schachter, who said the following. He said, you know, the Rav earned a PhD in philosophy at the University of Berlin. But the Rav never talked nor wrote about the importance of studying secular studies. You would think the Rav talked about Torah Amada, but the Rav never really talked about his position on Torah Amada on studying secular studies. When it comes to his view on religious Zionism, it's just the opposite. The Rav discussed it often. He lectured on it at different times. There's the famous 1956 lecture at Lamport Auditorium at Yeshiva University that's now known as Kol Dodi Dofek. It was all about the Rav's approach post-Holocaust to Medina Israel. Or the Chamesh Drashot, the five major lectures that he delivered in the 60s at the American Mizrahi Hapola Mizrahi Annual Convention. And they all dealt with the Rav's approach to religious Zionism. But to appreciate the Rav's view on religious Zionism, and it's a nuanced one, and we're going to come back to the first of the Chamesh Drashot at the very end of this lecture. But to really appreciate the Rav's view of religious Zionism, you have to know his biography. Because if you don't know his biography, you really won't appreciate how far he came. And it was a world of difference from where he was raised. Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik was born in Prusian, Poland, the city where his maternal grandfather was the Mara D'Asra, the Rav of the city. He was born on the 12th of Adar, 5663, or March 11th, 1903. His father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, was a descendant of the great, most probably the premier, Litvisha rabbinic family. They were disciples of Rav Chaim Volozhin, and his grandfather, his paternal grandfather, was known, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, was known as the Brisker Rav, because he was the Rav in Brisk. On his mother's side, and I should stop right now, I should ask you, which side of the family, and you'll hear in 2 seconds, but think about this, which side of the family influenced him in secular studies? Was it the Soloveitchik's family, or was it the mother's family? And you'll hear about this in a few seconds. The Rav's mother was Pesha Feinstein. She was born in 1880 and she died in 1967. Just as an aside, the Rav lost three relatives in 1967. He sat Shiva for his mother. He sat Shiva for his brother, Shmuel, who was a professor of chemistry at Yeshiva University. And he had sat Shiva for his Rebbetzin all the same year in 1967. The daughter of Pesha Feinstein was the daughter of Rabbi Elia Feinstein. Rabbi Feinstein died in 1929. He was the Mara D'Asra, the spiritual leader of Prusian. He was the author of the very respected work, Halichos Eliyahu. Rabbi Feinstein was known as Rabbi Elia Prusianer. He was the uncle to our great posek in America, Rav Moshe Feinstein. That meant that the Rav's mother was first cousins to Rav Moshe Zal. And the Rav had a very close relationship with Rav Moshe Feinstein throughout his entire life. The Rav lived in Prizren for the first 7 years of his life. During those years, the Rav's father learned with a select group in a kollel in Prizren. And the Rav, as a little boy, and he would describe this, he listened how his father would always defend the Rambam. At the shir, there was always a Rambam. And from that moment on, he fell in love with the Rambam. After Prizren, the Rav's father accepted his first rabbinic position from 1910 to 1913 in Ryazan, Lithuania. In 1913, he moved to a larger city called Khasilovich in White Russia. He remained at Khasilovich for 8 years until 1921, making this Khasilovich the city where the Rav spent his formative years from age 10 to age 18. At first, he learned in the local cheder, but when it was his mother who realized that the Malamed, Reb Baruch Reisberg, who was a Chabad Chosid, was teaching him more Tanya than Gemara, it was his mother who complained, and his mother said it had to change. She tried to insist that her husband, Reb Moshe, would teach his son, but she wasn't as influential upon her husband until she squealed, if you will, to Reb Chaim Brisker. Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, the Rav's son-in-law, Reb Aaron Zichrono Livracha, describes it in a beautiful passage in a biographical comment about his father-in-law. Listen to his words. For the better part of a year, young Soloveitchik's Talmudic progress was impeded while the study of Tanya, accompanied by enthralling stories of Hasidic lore, proceeded merrily apace. While Rav Moshe was somewhat slow to detect the true state of affairs, his wife herself, a learned daughter of a very respected and outstanding rabbinic scholar, was more perceptive. Detecting the slow rate of growth in her son's Talmudic knowledge, she prodded Rav Moshe to remedy the situation. Failing to obtain proper satisfaction, she finally complained to Rav Chaim, and upon the family's next visit to Brisk, Rav Chaim tested the budding scholar and found him wanting. The result was that Reb Chaim put his foot down and he told his son Reb Moshe, you are henceforth to take personal charge of Yoshef Ber's Talmudic education. And it was from that day on that the period of rigorous mutual study between father and son began. During this time, Rav Yoshef Ber, the young Soloveitchik, did not engage in any formal secular studies. However, he acquired a lifelong taste for literature from his mother, who led him through the best of Western civilization's literature, including Pushkin, Ibsen, Bialik, and others. In his late teens, the Rav acquired an equivalent of a gymnasia education, be compared to a high school education. He gained it from a series of tutors. It was only in 1924, at the age of 21, that Rav Soloveitchik was exposed to formal secular studies when he entered the local Free Polish University in Warsaw, where he studied political science for 3 semesters. In the fall of 1926, at the age of 23, the Rav made what most probably was the most drastic move of his lifetime. He moved from his father's home, from his parents' home, to Berlin to study philosophy at the University of Berlin. Rabbi Dr. J.J. Schachter remarked during a lecture on the Rav and this period, he says, and I quote J.J., he says, it is impossible to overstate the significance of this move from the Torah-centered traditional culture of Rav Soloveitchik's family and society to the secular metropolis of Berlin. We need to appreciate how lonely the Rav must have been as a young man now in Berlin. He left the familiar setting of his family, where he was totally saturated in Torah, to the foreign and alien culture of Berlin. It was an amazing culture shock for him. The Rav once told a Talmud, you have no idea how enormously difficult it was for me to move from the world of Reb Chaim to that of Berlin University. Even my children can't appreciate it because they already found a paved road. To support this presentation, there's a memoir that was found written by a Jew in Berlin from this period of time. And it's a fascinating personal family memoir written by this Jew. And this Jew, Werner Silberstein, and was published by the family in 1994, has an unbelievable historic passage. Here, Silberstein, a Berlin Jew, is describing what's happening to him in Berlin in the 1920s. He writes, and he says exactly the following words. In the 20s, I became acquainted with Joseph Dov Soloveitchik, a young man who just arrived in Berlin from Warsaw in order to study philosophy at the Berlin University. And this is the tale how I first met him. On Friday evenings, I often davened at the Adas Yisrael synagogue. On one such occasion, shortly before the service began, the brother-in-law of my colleague and friend came up to me and said to me, "Please, just look back. See, do you see who's in the back of the shul?" "Yes, I mean the young bacher." I did as I was told, and I turned to Silverman and I said, "So what? There's a young bacher there." He replied, "Take another look. Do you know who that bacher is? That is the grandson of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav. Already now, he's an Eloi, a genius. One day, he will be Echod Bedoro, the greatest of his generation." It didn't take long for us to become acquainted, Silberstein writes. He often came to our house in Berlin. It was one of the few where the Rav felt comfortable enough to eat, even on Pesach. In this connection, I would like to relate an unforgettable episode, Silberstein writes. During a visit a few days before Pesach, he replied to my wife, Rhea's invitation that he be our guest at the Pesach Seder. "Great," the Rav said, "but can I be present when you kasher your oven?" Could you imagine Rhea getting this request? Rav Soloveitchik asking, "I accept, but I have to be there when you kasher the oven." She answered, "With pleasure, but one proviso. Just with the request that you tell me quite honestly if something is not done correctly to your requirements. I shall do it the way I learned from my Baba, but if you want it differently, you have to tell me." Yosef Dov came at the appointed time for kashering of the stove. After a while, he suddenly disappeared. He just left. "Oh," said Rhea, "I obviously have failed the test." But lo and behold, a little later, a magnificent bouquet of flowers arrived with an acceptance of our invitation to participate in the Seder. In Berlin, the Rav majored in philosophy. He was attracted to the neo-Kantian school. At the university, he originally wanted to write on the Rambam and Plato. He wanted to demonstrate that Maimonidean scholarship up to his day had erred in seeing the Rambam as a confirmed Aristotelian. However, since there was no one in the university who knew the Rambam as well as the Rav, nobody could test him on Maimonides, and therefore he had to change his topic, and he wrote on the philosophical system of Hermann Cohn. In Silberstein's memoirs, just as a magnificent point of reference, he says about the Rav's oral examination the following. He studied philosophy under Professor Heinrich Meyer, mathematics at the Berlin University, where he made his PhD summa cum laude. During the examination, Professor Meyer asked him, "Well, Mr. Soloveitchik, what can you tell me about Maimonides?" Just imagine sitting there. I wish I was a fly on the wall. Just imagine sitting there. "Mr. Soloveitchik, what can you tell me about Maimonides?" The real challenge for the Rav was not because he couldn't tell him, but what do you tell the professor in 6 minutes that's going to size up the Rambam? He explained to the German professor the Rambam's significance of the historical aspect of philosophy. After a couple of sentences, Professor Meyer interrupted him and said, "All right, Mr. Soloveitchik, I see that you know a little about Maimonides." It was perhaps the most understated statement in contemporary history. There exist the notes of the professors who examined the Rav, actually, and one professor wrote gut, and the other wrote sehr gut. The oral exam was given July 24th, 1930, and the doctorate was dated December 10th, 1932. In Berlin, The Rav made friendships with acquaintances with a number of great rabbis, including of Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who was going to become the Rebbe, of Chaim Heller, Zichrono Livracha, who the Rav felt was the Godel Hador. He established the yeshiva in Berlin, and then Rav Chaim Heller moved from Germany, escaped Holocaust, and lived in Manhattan, and the Rav would go learn with him every week when he'd come from Boston. And Rav Dr. Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who was the Sweet Yesh. Although the Rav took his secular studies very seriously, he constantly immersed himself in Torah study during this time. Zionism was not part of his equation. The Rav's son, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, published a volume of Chidushei Torah that the Rav sent to his father during this time, demonstrating that the Rav was immersed in Torah even while he was at the University of Berlin. There were many Litvisha Rabbanim who would come to Berlin for medical needs, and they would always want to check up on Rav Soloveitchik. And so they'd want to see, really, is the Rav really learning Torah, or has he become a kofir because he's at the University of Berlin? And they would test him, and he would prove that he was brilliant in Torah even during this time. So the story goes, one Litvisha Rav asked him, he says, tell me, when do you have time to learn to be so fluent in Torah? He says, when you and your friends talk Lashon Hara about me, that's the time I'm learning. In the fall of 1930, the Rav went to Vilna to marry his wife, and they were married on June 16th, 1931. Her background was very similar to the Rav's. She was raised in Lithuania, and she sought a higher secular education in Western Europe. She earned a PhD in education from the Jena University. On August 29th, 1932, the young couple with their newly born baby daughter, Atara, arrived in America. The original plan was the Rav was going to go to the yeshiva in Chicago. But at the time they arrived, the Depression was in full force, and the yeshiva was unable to pay him his salary. The Rav's father, Reb Moshe, who already was living in New York since 1929 as a Rosh Yeshiva at Reitz, went to work trying to find his son, daughter, and granddaughter, daughter-in-law and granddaughter, a position. He found for his son the position of chief rabbi of the Vat HaOir in Boston. The Rav was installed as the head of 11 United Orthodox congregations in Boston on December 11, 1932. Numerous rabbis came to that installation. It's fascinating who came. Among them, and even though the Rav wasn't a Zionist at this time, was Rav Zev Gold, Rav Meir Berlin, and of course the Rav's father, Rav Moshe. Rav Soloveitchik was all of 29 years old when he accepted this position. The Rav was very active in the communal Rabbonis, and he created the first major day school, the first day school in New England in 1937. And all of this time, the Rav had no interest whatsoever at all in Zionism. He was also, by the way, very involved in kashrus in Boston. There are articles that documented how he picketed butcher shops in Jewish neighborhoods in Boston that weren't kosher or weren't kosher enough. In 1939, he became embroiled in a terrible, terrible controversy on behalf of the Shochtim, and he was accused by the butcher shops of taking money, which the Rav never did. After a 14-month investigation, the entire episode, which was brought to the Attorney General of Massachusetts, the judge, Abraham K. Cohn, declared about the Rav. He cleared him and exonerated the Rav, and he said, all of the accusations are sheer fabrications. The other very important event that occurred during this time happened in 1935. The Rav was all of 32 years old. The Rav journeyed to Eretz Yisrael, to Palestine. It was his first and his only trip to Eretz Yisrael. He went in order to be a candidate for the position of Ashkenazic Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv. On this trip, he lectured at many of the yeshivot. He spellbound everybody that heard him. In his campaign for the Chief Rabbinate of Tel Aviv, the Rav ran, it was boiled down to 33 candidates. Actually, there were 42 candidates, and they boiled it down to three candidates. And the three candidates were the Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, and who was at that time the chief rabbi of Ireland and would later become the chief rabbi of Eretz Israel following Rav Kook, and Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel, who was at that time the Rav in Antwerp, and he was a major leader in the Mizrahi, a major religious Zionist figure. In an attempt to alleviate the fears of those who felt that the Rav was too young, he was all of 32, to become chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, wrote a letter to Rav Yaakov Bominger, the secretary of the Religious Council of Tel Aviv. The letter read as follows. I've heard that it is said that my son is too young. First, this is not true. He's between 30 and 40 years. He didn't say he's 32. Between 30 and 40 years. In the previous generations, those possessing outstanding abilities were already appointed to the most illustrious and influential rabbinical positions at such an age. They soon became the leading rabbis of their times. The elder rabbis coexisted with their younger colleagues in love and brotherhood, and they honored one another. Rav Amiel, who was in his prime at the time, was selected as chief rabbi in that campaign. It's reported that the Rav's great uncle, Rav Meir Berlin, the president of World Mizrahi, declared about the three the following. He said, the greatest Talmud Chacham of the three, Yosef Ber Soloveitchik. The greatest Tzaddik, Rav Herzig. The next chief rabbi, Rav Amiel. He was the decider. It was Rav Meir Berlin who was going to decide. But why did the great uncle, Rav Meir Berlin, not want to have his nephew, who he said was the greatest scholar? In an article entitled The Rav as a Communal Leader, Rabbi Bernard Rosenzweig wrote the following in tradition as follows. The Rav himself was a card-carrying member of Agudath Yisrael. In 1935, he traveled to Israel for the first and only time in his life to try out for the position of chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. He made a brilliant impression. All his shurim, all his lectures were well received by everybody, but he was not elected. The reason that was given was that he was too young. He was 32. The real reason, Rosenzweig writes, was that his great uncle, Meir Berlin, voted against him because of his Aguda credentials. The Rav was the star of Aguda conventions. People flocked to hear him. For example, when the Gadol Hador of Chaim Ozer Gradinsky died in 1940, it was the Rav who delivered the masterful hesped over Reb Chaim at the Aguda convention. At that time, no one questioned the Rav's credentials and his Berlin doctorate. That they didn't care about. That was not a detriment for the Aguda. He was given the honored position in the Agudat Yisrael hierarchy. However, in the 40s, something drastically changed. The Rav went under a slow transformation. And by the 50s, he became a committed religious Zionist. The Rav admits that, quote, links with Mizrahi grew gradually, end of quote, that he had his, quote, doubts and reservations about the validity of the Mizrahi approach, and that his decision ran counter to the family tradition. But the Rav made his decision firmly on behalf of religious Zionists of Mizrahi. He was impressed by its achievements. He was convinced that from the point of view of history, religious Zionism had saved the honor of religious Jews. It had created, a quote, a network of schools in which B'nai Akiva Yeshivot and Hesder Yeshivot are the crown. It has ensured the unity of the Jewish people by making matters of personal status answerable to the chief rabbinate and excluding civil marriage, end of quote. The Rav recognized this and affirmed that without the pioneering efforts of the Mizrahi, the yeshiva world, the Rav would say, could not have transplanted itself to Eretz Yisrael in the aftermath of the Holocaust. The daily paper, Haaretz, reported a number of times that party politics played a very important and major role in the election of the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. The paper noted that the date of the election itself was tampered with and delayed due to party politics. What is most interesting is that Haaretz published an editorial in support of Harav Amiel, and another one extolling the virtues of Rav Herzig. The paper ignored the Rav. No comment about Rav Soloveitchik in Haaretz. Seth Farber, a historian who has published on the Rav's life and in particular his establishment of the Maimonides school, suggests that this was due to the fact that at this juncture in the Rav's life, he was ambivalent at best to Zionism, and the paper therefore had no interest in Rav Soloveitchik. The tally of the vote was as follows for Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv, 1935. Rav Amiel, 22. Rabbi Herzig, 10. Rabbi Soloveitchik, 9. One person abstained. Haaretz reported that when the announcement that the Rav had lost the vote was made, everybody thought that the Rav was going to win. When the Rav had lost, people at the Tel Aviv municipality began to dance in the streets. They didn't want an agudist as the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. It's interesting to note that Dr. Lyman has suggested that there might be a different interpretation to the story that has nothing to do with the aguda. He says the failure to appoint the chief rabbi at Tel Aviv in 1935 may very well be connected with an earlier issue that occurred in Eretz Yisrael in 1933. In 1933, after the rise of the Nazi Party, January 30th, 1933, in Germany, the head of the Hildesheimer Rabbinic Seminary in Berlin, where the Sweet Yesh was now the Rosh Yeshiva, came to Eretz Yisrael. They saw the vision. They saw in 1933 what was coming, and they went. Hildesheimer himself, one of the Hildesheimer's grandson, Azriel Hildesheimer's grandson, who was then the rector of the yeshiva, went to Eretz Yisrael in order to arrange to move the yeshiva to Eretz Yisrael. The rabbis in Israel, with the support of Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski in Vilna, opposed the move in 1933 to such an extent that the move never happened. The Hildesheimer Beis Medrash never moved. It was going to be closed by the Nazis right after Kristallnacht and never reopened. The Israeli rabbinate argued that Israel was no place for rabbis with secular education. If you know anything about the Hildesheimer Academy, it required that not only did you get smicha, but with your smicha, you were supposed to have a doctorate in some field. And so it was Rabbiner Doctor, or Dr. Rabbiner. And the rabbis living in Eretz Yisrael, Schneer Lyman points out, were bitterly, bitterly opposed to having these German rabbis come to Eretz Yisrael. What they were really worried about, Dr. Lyman points out, was that these German-trained rabbis would win all of the positions, and the yeshivish graduates would have no jobs. So all of the rabbonim and the Rosh Yeshiva and the other yeshivas turned to Reb Chaim Ozer Grudzinski and put pressure on him, saying that they should not allow, at that time, the Hildesheimer Academy to move to Eretz Yisrael. It's fascinating, by the way, that Rav Chaim Ezer Grudzinski wrote about the Hildesheimer Academy a very disparaging comment. He wrote, it's a Beit Charoshet L'Rabbanim. And one of his comments he wrote, it was a Beit Charoshet L'Rabbanim, which means it's a factory to produce rabbis. And the Sri Deyesh responded to Rav Chaim Ozer, who he had tremendous respect for, everybody did. He says, that is so not true. We are not a Beit Charoshet L'Rabbanim, just the opposite. But bottom line, Rav Chaim Ozer put the pressure upon the Israeli rabbinate not to allow for the Hildesheimer Academy to move to Eretz Yisrael. In light of this bitter opposition, any rabbi with a secular degree becoming chief rabbi of Tel Aviv would be objected to, would be rejected. And the Rav came with a PhD from the University of Berlin. I have only one little problem with this argument, and that is Rav Herzig had a PhD. So why was Rav Herzig not opposed? Why did they not oppose Rav Herzig? And they did not oppose Rav Herzig. They opposed Rav Soloveitchik, and Rav Herzig is going to become the next chief rabbi right after Rav Kook dies in 1935. Rav Kook dies in Gimel Elul in 1935. So I don't think it was really the Rav's PhD that didn't get him the job. I honestly do believe that Mayor Berlin, his great uncle, wasn't going to have an agudist be the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv in 1935. So now we must ask, How did the transformation from an Aguda loyalist to Mizrahi leader happen? What was the theological basis, if you will? How can we explain it? And we don't have to go far, because the Rav explains it for us. He explains it in numerous places, but I'm going to use as our text his first drasha in Chamesh Drashot, which has also been, by the way, if you want, translated in a book called The Rav Speaks. It's published by Tal Orot Institute in Yerushalayim. You can get a hold of it. Beautiful drashot. The articles comprise the works of five different drashot, five different addresses that Rav Soloveitchik was going to give every year to the Mizrahi Convention in America between the years 1962 and 1967. They originally were published in the original Yiddish that they were delivered in, subsequently into Hebrew, called Chamesh Drashot, and then into English. For our study, we're going to focus on the first of those lectures. It's called Yosef Dreamt a Dream, or Joseph Dreamt a Dream. For it's in this lecture that the Rav clearly explains his affinity with religious Zionism and his transformation from an Agudist, if you will, into a supporter of the Mizrahi. He understands the story in the Torah of Yosef and his brothers, not as a simple sibling rivalry of jealousy between brothers, but rather as a profound debate that still resonates in Yiddishkeit to this very day. It's therefore the use of this story in the Torah that the Rav finds his theological pinning for his commitment to religious Zionism. The Rav takes us through the very famous story, and he notes that after Yosef told his brothers his dreams at the very beginning of Parshas Vayeshev, we are told that he went to search for them. They see him finally, and what does the Torah record? And the Rav saw so much meaning in these three words, Vayiro so merachok, and they saw him from afar. They never able to bridge that distance. That distance was so great. The debate was so great. And they just couldn't see eye to eye. There was, and there still is, the Rav says, a lack of communication. Let's not for a moment forget that the Shvatim represented the Torah sages. Levi was the tribe of Torah scholars. Yehuda were our leaders. Binyamin were certainly the tzaddikim, the saintly ones. So what was the argument all about? Yosef was worried that at that very first pasuk that begins the dreams, Vayeshev Yaakov Beretz Megurei Aviv, and Yaakov dwelt in the land of his father's sojourning, and everything seemed so pleasant, that idea of pleasant, wonderful living wasn't going to last and endure. He worried that Yaakov would not be able to stay quietly in the land because he heard ringing in his ears an earlier nevuah, an earlier prophecy that contested this very idea. And that was from Bereshis Tesfav Yud Gimel. Vayomer l'Avram, Yadoa teida, ki ger yeh zaracha be'eretz lo lohem. Your seed shall be a stranger in a foreign land. Well, how do you adapt to a foreign land? He kept hearing this. The Rav says, he kept hearing this in his ears. Yosef hearing this, that this was their destiny. They were going to move to a foreign land. How are they going to adapt to this foreign land? And he kept hearing this verse in his ears, and he felt that we had to prepare. And his dreams were the preparation. He was telling his brothers, be prepared. These dreams that I have are more than just a dream. They're, if you will, a direction on how we have to act. That was the first, right? The first dream. For behold, we are binding sheaves in the field. This dream was a drastic change for the Shvatim. What were they professionally? They were shepherds. What's Yosef dreaming? Dreaming being a farmer, a new economic structure with new styles of living, characteristics and laws. He was interested and a new framework within which tradition could be kept. The brothers didn't understand Yosef. They viewed the future from the present and could only see everything being the same as it is now. Life would continue as always, but Yosef didn't stop. Yosef had a second dream. Now he dreamt V'hashemesh v'hayareach v'achad asar kochavim. The sun, the moon, the 11 stars. It's a revolutionary image, the Rav would say, for here the entire constellation of the world is changing before us. He's dreaming a secular culture, great and powerful, with great technological wonders. Yosef realizes that one day we will have to encounter this culture, and we better be prepared when we encounter the culture. And I quote the Rav, "We must render Abraham's heritage triumphant in the alien surroundings. Abraham's Torah is very powerful, but only when we are prepared for the conflict and know exactly what to do in a new environment." Yosef was arguing they were going to be moving to a new environment. You have to prepare for that new environment. You have to study that new environment. You have to know how to tackle that new environment. The Shvatim saw it differently. They deplored the dreams. Vayikanu bo echav. They were jealous of him. They couldn't understand. There was no communication. They felt one can't meddle in the secrets of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But the more Yosef stood his ground, their hatred grew and grew and grew. Now we must ask the ultimate question, the Rav says. After all was said and done, with whom did HaKadosh Baruch Hu, did the Providence side? Was it Yosef or was it the Shvatim? The answer, as the Rav writes, is Yosef saved the house of Yaakov. For without his dreams, we would have been wiped away and lost forever. It is this very same argument that raged with religious Zionism, Rav Soloveitchik is telling us, in that first of the Chamesh Drashot. He notes it's the same argument all over again. The Torah leaders, he said, saw everything from Vilna, from Brisk, from Warsaw. They couldn't understand how one could dare join forces with the non-observant. How do you join forces with the people who don't even eat kosher, don't keep Shabbos, are secular, who talk about a Zionism? It can't be kosher because they're being led by non-observant Jews. They would quote from Divrei HaYamim Beis, "When you joined the wicked, God destroyed your acts." This was a very good argument of the Rashi HaYeshiva and of the Rabbanim that were anti the religious Zionist position. But the Rav goes on and he says, don't for a moment think that Mizrahi didn't feel uncomfortable. The Rabbanim in Mizrahi that sided with Mizrahi felt very uncomfortable. But they saw something was happening. They realized that a new dawn to a new age was breaking. The tranquility of Torah in Europe was coming to an end, and they felt they better be prepared. They saw us binding sheaves, and they saw the technology and the culture of the West would become a major influence. What a nevuah, right? This country is the center of technology today. Yes, Mizrahi joined forces with free thinkers to build a new opportunity, but the goals were different. The Mizrahi had a different goal than the non-religious Zionists. Our view, as the Rav writes, and he told the Mizrahi in 1962, our view of Eretz Yisrael is one word. It's Torah. We don't understand Zionism any other way but the Zionism of Torah. It's important to note that, okay, now you know how the Rav literally moved from a family saturated in a position that was totally anti. By the way, his grandfather, Reb Chaim Brisker, went to the first convention of the Aguda, and he walked out. He thought they were too interested, if you will. They didn't have enough substance. That was the argument that he gave. But he didn't even stay. He was even anti the Aguda, Reb Chaim. So you saw his history, you saw his biography, and now you see in a very short period of time that we're allowed it, where the Rav was thinking. What was the Rav thinking when he transformed himself from this Aguda leader who was giving the hesped for Reb Chaim Iser at the Aguda convention to the honorary president of the Mizrahi, Apollo Mizrahi of America? It's important to note, and I want to conclude with a few more comments. that the Rav's view of religious Zionism was not Rav Kook's view. Rav Kook, Zichrono Livracha, had a totally different view from the Rav. Rav Kook was a makubal. He was a mystical thinker who viewed Zionism in mystical terms. I remember once in Shir, the Rav said, "I really don't understand Rav Kook. I would tell you, if you want to learn Rav Kook, his commentary on the Siddur is a masterpiece." That's what the Rav said. Olat Riya is a masterpiece. But he says, "I've tried to learn Rav Kook." He didn't relate in so many ways to Rav Kook's thinking. But the language, the discourse of Rav Kook was that of a mystic who viewed religious Zionism as the beginning of a messianic era. That's how Rav Kook saw it. The Rav, on the other hand, I would like to suggest the Rav was a realistic, pragmatic, halachic thinker. That's what motivated the Rav. His view of religious Zionism was one based on a rational, pragmatic thought, as I've documented for you. This fact explains the Rav's view on returning land for peace. People don't sometimes realize this today. The Rav advocated that even Yerushalayim could be negotiated if real peace would be achieved. Real peace. When asked who the authority is to decide real peace, the Rav said, "You have to go to the experts." And who are the experts? He said, "The military, security people are the experts, not the religious, or for that matter, the political thinkers. They're not the experts. We have to decide. If lives will be saved, that's more important than land." The school of Rav Kook disagreed bitterly with this thinking. For them, the land itself is sacrosanct and could not be negotiated at all costs. This school, of course, created the Gush Emunim and everything that followed from the Gush Emunim. One final note. His own son-in-law, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zichron Livracha, commented that the fact that the Rav wanted to move to Eretz Yisrael, wanted to go to become chief rabbi in 1935, Rav Aaron said he wasn't interested in a job. That wasn't why he went to Eretz Yisrael. He wanted, honestly, to make aliyah. That is why he wanted to. And at that time, he was not affiliated with the Mizrahi at all. At that time, as you know from the biography, he was affiliated with the Aguda. But he had a love for Eretz Yisrael. It was a deep love for Eretz Yisrael. And it transcended all affiliations with any movement. And the Rav really wanted at that time to live in Eretz Yisrael. He wasn't ever to go back to Eretz Yisrael. Many, many theories on why he didn't go back. You know that Ben-Gurion came right after Rav Herzig died. There was a number of years between Rav Herzig dies in 1959. When does Rav Unterman, Zichron Livracha, become the next chief rabbi? Does anybody know? It took 5 years, 1964. 5 years they didn't have a chief rabbi. And Ben-Gurion came, and he begged Rav Soloveitchik to be the chief rabbi. And the Rav, as you and I know, did not accept. And there are many theories why the Rav didn't accept. After his wife died, they said he was going to go. He bought a ticket. He was going to go to Eretz Yisrael. He didn't go to Eretz Yisrael. And by the way, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein has a magnificent piece on the Rav's attitude about Hallel and Yom HaAtzmaut. And he says, the Rav was not pro-Hallel the way we say Hallel in most shuls on Yom HaTzmaut. The Rav had a totally different position. But it wasn't an issue of, and this is what Rav Aaron points out, you can't decide, does the Rav love Eretz Yisrael, did the Rav have love for Medinat Yisrael or not? Of course he had. But it was a halachic question. The Rav was a halachist, ish halacha. That was the Rav. He was a pragmatic thinker. And that's how you have to understand the Rav. And he wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael in 1935 because of his enormous love of Eretz Yisrael. And finally, in light of this, it's just interesting to note that around the time of the Six-Day War, Rav Lichtenstein points out, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav's son, came to Eretz Yisrael for a short while. The Rav was concerned. It was 1967, and things were boiling over in Eretz Yisrael, Medinat Yisrael. And the Rav was concerned for his safety. But never, ever Did he hesitate for a moment to say, you have to come back? And with great pride, Rav Lichtenstein says, he would talk about his son being in Eretz Yisrael at that time. In later years, he took great pride in the fact that his own grandchildren served in Tzahal. The Rav would talk about that within the framework of Yeshivot Hesder. And finally, when the Rav was awarded a prize worth a considerable amount of money, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein says he would not pocket a penny. He didn't keep a penny for himself. The Rav rather contributed it to the organization of Hesder Yeshivot. That was what he felt was the crown achievement of the Mizrahi HaPol HaMizrahi. This was the Zionism of the Rav. It was a nuanced Zionism. It was a pragmatic Zionism. It was an enormous jump for him to have become the Mizrahi leader that he did become. So remember two things. Yes, there was an enormous transformation biographically of the Rav from where he grew up to becoming the Mizrahi leader that he was. And always remember, you can't say his approach to Zionism was the same as Rav Kook. Drastically different. Rav Kook being the mystical thinker and the Rav seeing it in a more pragmatic perspective. Medinat Yisrael was the reality. In particular, the Rav was once asked, why were we Zoche? Why is this generation Zoche? I said this in my shul right before the Shabbos of Yom HaTzmaut. I quoted the Rav on this. I said, why were we Zoche? Do you ever think about it? To have Medinat Yisrael? If you ask me, and I've said this on numerous occasions, I feel so blessed living in this generation. It's such an amazing generation. We have Eretz, it's 70 years. We have Eretz. I was 12 years old during the Six-Day War. I remember that greatness. I wasn't born 70 years ago, but I remember my father, Zichrono Livracha, and my mother, may she live a long life, telling me all about that greatness. And we're sitting here in Citi Field, and we have the zchut of Medinat Yisrael. And the Rav was asked, but there were many generations before us that certainly were more pious. Why were we zochet to it? And the Rav said, I don't think after the Holocaust we could have continued without that gift. We needed that gift. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us that gift. And that's that gift that we have to thank Hashem for every minute of the day. And I conclude by an interesting comment that I heard. I'm a Cleveland boy. And so I told you I was 12 years old when I was when the Six-Day War broke out. And we had Tehillim gatherings in Cleveland, like everywhere. And I remember Rav Gifter, the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Gifter Zichrono Livracha, of Tells. I went to the Hebrew Academy of Cleveland. It was run by Tells. And I remember Rav Gifter saying right after the Six-Day War, you know, certain things you'll never forget. So I was told, but I'll never forget Rav Gifter saying that if we had lost the Six-Day War, that would have been a matir for Jews to be killed in Times Square. That's what Rav Gifter said. And the gift of Medinat Yisrael is unbelievable. Rabbi Moshe Heyer from the Wiesenthal Center, Rabbi Marvin Heyer says to me all the time, he says, if you think I could get into the White House without the State of Israel, you're wrong. We get into the White House and we get into Congress because we have the State of Israel. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu bless the State of Israel with shalom, and may we all just appreciate the understanding of the Rav when it came to his Zionism. Thank you.